Well, let me start by thanking Bloomberg for the opportunity to talk to you all today. I discussed a very similar topic to this one at this same venue about 18 months ago. The outlook for non-mining business investment, that's an important element of our forecasts. It depends on a range of forces acting on the economy, including the stimulus currently being provided by the very low level of interest rates. But forecasting activity is hard, and understanding and forecasting business investment is arguably harder still. When I was here in April of last year, I'd suggested that first, mining investment would be likely to peak in 2013, that non-mining investment would be likely to pick up, but only gradually, and that growth for the economy as a whole would be a little below trend in 2013 and then gradually pick up through 2014. Just to give you a bit of a sense of things, this suggests that it now looks like mining investment peaked in late 2012. Despite a substantial decline in mining investment since then, growth of the economy overall has actually picked up to a pace that was around trend over the course of the past year, and much of that improvement owed to a sharp rise in resource exports. At the same time, there's been an improvement in the growth rate of economic activity in the non-mining sectors, even though non-mining business investment has remained subdued. This better growth of non-mining activity, I think, often gets missed given all the focus on the resources boom. And while this improvement is welcome, a key question is how durable the improvement will be. It might even gather a bit more steam, thereby helping to drive overall growth to an above-trend pace at some point. Such developments are possible, but by no means certain. They depend in part on non-mining business investment, and that's hence the motivation for my talk today. So let me just review some of the recent past. Over recent years, non-mining business investment has been subdued. After growing from the decline that followed the global financial crisis, non-mining business investment in real terms has been little changed over the past 3 years or so. In nominal terms, non-mining business investment is at a very low level as a share of GDP relative to its history. Non-mining business investment should depend, in large part, on the strength of expected demand in the non-mining sectors of the economy. Current demand conditions, however, may have a strong influence on investment for two reasons. The first is that firms tend to draw on their recent experience when assessing prospects for future demand. And the second is that stronger sales today will boost current cash flows, which will assist firms that might be facing financial constraints. Hence, the gradual pickup in the growth of non-mining economic activity that I just showed you before over the past year, that augurs well for investment. Low interest rates and robust population growth are underpinning strong demand in the housing market, with housing prices rising rapidly and dwelling investment picking up strongly. Low interest rates are also providing a measure of support to growth of consumption at a time when subdued conditions in the labour market are weighing on the growth of incomes. These developments, as well as growth in export industries such as tourism and education, they're consistent with a pickup in business conditions across a range of industries. Now, despite these gains, survey measures of non-mining capacity utilisation have not improved much over the past year. A measure derived from the NAB survey implies that capacity utilisation remains a bit below average. By itself, that suggests that demand in the non-mining sector will need to rise a little further before businesses feel the need to undertake substantial investment in new capacity. Our forecast for the economy suggests that this will occur in time, but the extent and the timing of that new investment remains uncertain. Now, it's not just demand or output that matters. In addition to the strength of demand, a range of other factors also influence investment decisions. In particular, investment depends on whether the expected return on new capital outweighs the cost of installing it. In other words, a firm should invest whenever the market value of its existing capital is greater than its book value. This is known in academic circles as Tobin's Q theory of investment, where Q is the ratio of the market value to the book value of capital. Now, that's all well and good, but it turns out that empirical support for the relationship between investment and the Q ratio is weak for the economy as a whole. But looking here at some individual company data, it's possible to show that such a relationship exists. Estimates from Tobin Q type models based on Australian firm level data indicate that non-mining investment has been unusually weak by historical standards in recent years. And that's true even after we control for things such as sales growth and cash flows. Now, for firms in the bank's liaison program, it also appears that investment's been weaker than recent growth in sales would suggest. So with that in mind, let's consider some of the possible explanations for the weakness in non-mining business investment and what that might imply for the outlook. So one possibility is just that the cost of borrowing remains too high or external finance is too difficult to access. My discussion so far has ignored the fact that firms face financing constraints of varying degrees. And certain types of finance are more costly to obtain than others. In particular, the cost of external equity finance is typically greater than the cost of external debt, and in turn, that's greater than the cost of internal funding. Financial constraints certainly became much more pervasive for many firms as the global financial crisis unfolded. However, those constraints have eased over time, and more recently, external financing has become widely available at very favourable cost. Primarily, this reflects the stance of monetary policy, both in Australia and abroad, which is delivering historically low levels of interest rates, ample liquidity, and has helped to push up equity prices. Indeed, a common refrain of the firms that we talk to in the course of our business liaison has been that neither the cost nor the availability of external finance have been factors limiting investment of late. Moreover, corporate balance sheet data indicate that many Australian companies currently hold relatively high levels of cash, suggesting that they have access to resources to finance investment when the time comes. Perhaps the exchange rate is too high. Well, the exchange rate's declined somewhat relative to its peak in the first half of 2013, but it remains high, especially given the sizable decline in commodity prices this year. The implications of this vary across the traded and the non-traded sectors. A further decline in the exchange rate would provide additional support to demand for domestic firms producing tradable goods and services. At the same time, however, the high exchange rate currently also means that imported capital goods are relatively cheap. Hence, the still high level of the exchange rate may be a positive factor for investment plans of some firms in non-tradable industries. For firms in tradable industries, on the other hand, the low cost of imported capital is offset by the effect of the high exchange rate on the demand for the goods and services that they produce. In short, the exchange rate might be playing a part in restraining investment in some sectors of the economy, but I don't think it's likely to be the full story. So the next likely candidate is animal spirits. Perhaps animal spirits are too weak. Well, what's often referred to as animal spirits actually consists, in my mind, of three elements. So the first is uncertainty, and that describes the range of possible outcomes, let's say for demand, but other things like costs matter as well. So that's the first. The second is expected or the most likely outcome. So together, uncertainty and the expected or most likely outcome, those describe the distribution of possible outcomes. But even given that, that's not enough. We also need to know about firms' willingness to invest, which depends on the third element, which is their appetite for risk. So I'm going to consider each of those in turn. The outlook. Perhaps the outlook's too uncertain. Well, on the surface, uncertainty seems like an appealing explanation for subdued investment. However, we've got to remember that firms always have to make investment decisions in an environment of uncertainty, not just about the prospects for the economy overall, but also for their particular industries. Rather, the question we really need to ask ourselves is whether uncertainty in recent years has been elevated. Uh, There are a number of ways that we might try and actually measure the extent of uncertainty. One often used measure is the volatility of firms' share prices, shown in the top panel here. Another is the dispersion of analyst forecasts of firms' earnings. And a third can be constructed by looking carefully through the proportion of news stories that mention uncertainty, and that's shown in the lower panel. These measures all increased noticeably at the time of the global financial crisis, and all of the measures have since declined to be around the level seen prior to the financial crisis, when non-mining business investment had been growing strongly. Well, perhaps expectations regarding demand are still too weak. Even if uncertainty about the range of possible demand outcomes is not too different from the past, as this chart suggests, the most likely outcome, the mean of the distribution, that might still be too weak to lead to significant new investment projects. Business surveys, they ask firms what they expect conditions will be like in the near future, and the results are often described as business confidence. The long-running NAB survey suggests that business confidence was in decline and below its long-run average up to the middle of last year, but since then it's picked up noticeably. And this improvement was shortly followed by a broad-based pickup in the survey's measure of actual business conditions, which are shown here in the lower panel, and those are a little bit above average, according to both the NAB survey and a number of other business surveys. I think that's true. However, our liaison program, what that suggests to us is that businesses are generally reluctant to take on significant new investment projects until they can be confident of a more sustained improvement in demand conditions. So how long do those conditions need to hold at above average levels before the improvement's considered to be sustainable? Well, we don't know the answer to that. In part, that's because animal spirits aren't mechanical. They're not predictable. What matters for your investment plans is not just what you think about the future, but what you think your competitors think about the future. In part, this is because if your competitors are less than enthused about investing, the pressure for you to invest to avoid being left behind is lessened, and vice versa. So let me come to risk aversion. Perhaps risk aversion is quite elevated. So even though measures of uncertainty appear to have declined and firms' confidence about future conditions is a bit above average, firms' investment plans may sit idle if they are more risk averse than in the past. It's clear that firms became more risk averse at the onset of the global financial crisis. It seems that they remain affected, though, by that experience. Even though the direct effects of the crisis on the Australian economy were generally short-lived and relatively minor compared with the experience certainly of many economies, the events of that time led many Australian businesses and households to reevaluate their appetites for risk. So at the time, the household sector increased its savings rate noticeably. At the time of the crisis, it remains around the more prudent levels now than had been the norm in earlier decades. Also, businesses, they deleveraged at the time of the global crisis and have built up their levels of cash holdings. Well, one measure of firms' appetite for risk is embedded in their hurdle rates of return. So these serve as a rule of thumb for firms to evaluate whether or not to proceed with a particular project. So the higher the hurdle, the less likely any given project is going to be given the go-ahead. There's no evidence that hurdle rates of return have increased over recent years, but neither is there evidence that they've declined, even though the average cost of capital for firms has fallen quite dramatically. This larger gap between the hurdle and the average cost of capital, that implies actually that there's been a reduction in firms' appetite for risk. And that result, which is consistent with information from our liaison program, that result appears to be something of a global phenomenon. Our liaison provides other sorts of evidence of a more cautious approach to investment over recent years. Many firms tell us that they now require investment projects to satisfy a much shorter payback period and be approved at much higher levels of management than was typically the case in the past. There might be some other long-run determinants that we should consider. Just illustrate with one example. The current weakness in non-mining business may reflect a candidate such as this, which is multi-factor productivity growth, which will have a long-run bearing on things. Relatively weak growth of productivity over much of the past decade, that would have weighed on the return to capital and reduced incentives to add to the capital stock in non-mining business, in non-mining industries. If productivity growth were to remain relatively low, well, that would weigh on overall growth of the economy. And low growth of investment would naturally follow from that low growth of productivity, but it wouldn't be the cause of the weak growth of the overall economy. In any case, it's pretty hard to know exactly what productivity growth is likely to do in the future. More recently, as you can see here, multi-factor productivity growth appears to have increased a little. It's currently not that far from growth rates seen prior to this exceptional period of strong growth in the mid-90s. So in summary, look, some of the explanations have more merit than others. External finance, it's generally readily available at very low cost. So this, to my mind, can't explain the weakness in non-mining business investment. Looking at the available data, it's hard to argue that the heightened uncertainty is playing much, if any, role. Rather, some combination of relatively low growth in domestic demand, the effects of the still high exchange rate, a lack of confidence, and a lower appetite for risk, they all appear plausible. There are some metrics which are consistent with that, and it aligns well with what businesses say to us is holding them back. Well, we've got some data that might tell us something about the future. The Australian Bureau of Statistics, in this regard, the Australian Bureau of Statistics Capital Expenditure Survey, the CapEx survey, that provides a measure of firms' investment plans for up to 18 months ahead. The most recent survey implies a modest increase in nominal non-mining business investment in this current financial year in the order of 4.5%. The survey suggests investments likely to rise for a number of industries, including rental, hiring and real estate, information, media and technology, retail, construction. This picture, that's consistent, to my mind, with ongoing recovery in household expenditure, including on dwelling investment and in non-residential building construction. Investment is expected to decline in the manufacturing sector and for utilities. Just having a look at some of that data, given the fact that firms adapt their plans as events unfold, the early readings on investment from the CapEx survey for a given year often turn out to be wrong. We can see the extent of this, which is shown here, by comparing the early estimates for a given year with the final estimate for that year with the CapEx data. It's shown here based on the third estimate. So this is the third estimate versus the seventh estimate. We can see that even over the course of just a few quarters, business investment can turn out to be quite a bit higher or quite a bit lower than the most recent reading from the survey suggests. For example, investment covered by the CapEx survey was much weaker than had initially been expected in the early 1990s recession and in the slowdown in the early 2000s. But then it was stronger than initially expected in the mid-2000s and indeed over the past financial year, that last one's for 2013-14. So in short, if firms decide to undertake more investment than they had earlier anticipated, that investment can come about relatively quickly. So let me draw together a few conclusions. Non-mining business investment has been subdued and measures of capacity utilisation remain a bit below average levels. Meanwhile, over the past year or so, there's been a gradual increase in the pace of growth of economic activity outside of the mining sector, owing in part to the very low level of interest rates. Subdued investment has been consistent with a period of greater uncertainty and below average confidence. However, a number of indicators, which I've shown you, suggest that uncertainty has declined to levels seen prior to the global financial crisis. Also, measures of business confidence have picked up over the course of the past year to be a bit above long-run average levels. While this is a welcome development, it may not be sufficient to spur investment if businesses' appetite for risk remains relatively low. Moreover, the still high level of the exchange rate may be weighing on investment, of firms in the traded sector. Nevertheless, there are tangible indications, I think, that non-mining business investment will grow at a modest pace this financial year. And if firms' willingness to take on risk improves, investment could easily be stronger still. Now, it's always hard to know if and when such a change in sentiment might occur, but it's more likely to do so when the fundamental determinants of investment are in place and the ready availability of internal and external finance at very low cost. That's one element of that. The stronger growth of demand that we've seen in non-mining parts of the economy over the past year or so is another. So if history is any guide, eventually the period that we're in now of elevated risk aversion is likely to give way to a concern amongst businesses, not of the losses, but of lost opportunities and a loss of market share. So let me finish there and take it. Thanks, Angus.
Well, good morning, Chris. Thank you very much indeed for coming in this morning. Thank you for your presentation, very comprehensive. And good morning to everybody here. Don't forget to start submitting your questions through your phones. I will be coming to you in a little bit after I've given Chris a bit of a grilling, and your questions will appear in front of Willie. So, Chris, before we talk about Australia and the details in your talk, let's take a look at the world. It's hard to recall a time when there were so many areas of conflict and uncertainty involving so many countries simultaneously. Now Australian forces have joined the battle in Iraq. I'm interested to hear your views. To what extent is the global economy at risk given the battles in the Middle East?
Well, I think what we've said is that financial market prices have been remarkably stable for a period of time. Volatility is very low, and that's surprising in light of some of these global events taking place. So it's possible that such events and conflicts could flare up to be even larger than they are now and lead to significant problems or concerns about, in the Middle East, perhaps the supply of oil, for example. Mm-hmm. So that could have sort of knock-on effects. Specifically about individual events, I'm none the wiser than you are.
To what extent are we isolated from it, do you think?
Oh, we're not. We're a small open economy dependent on trade with the rest of the world and with financial market, sort of open financial markets and inflows of capital. So we're not isolated. Those sorts of things could have an effect on us. But it's not entirely clear to me that those events are particularly elevated at the moment compared to sort of other similar disruptive, difficult events in the past.
Okay. Turning to events this week, G20 officials are converging on Cairns, but at the same time, the biggest economies seem to be headed in anything but the same direction in the world. The US is improving. In Europe, there are growing fears of deflation. In China, there are signs of a slowdown. So how is it possible to coordinate global policy in this kind of climate?
Well, people often talk about that in the context of central banks. I think central bankers are very conscious of particularly in the larger economies, what their policies imply for other economies. But in the main, they have to follow their own mandates. And ultimately, if they do that well, if they manage to sort of create an environment where growth's as strong as it can be, but inflation contained, well, that's good for all concerned. I think you're right, though, that one of the key issues is, for us, our forecasts that we've published fairly recently were for our major trading partner growth to remain around average levels, maybe pick up just a touch in the coming year or so. And that seems rather strange because all of the economies that you can point to seem to have a bit slower growth now than they have in recent years or in previous years. And part of the reason is just because our exposure to China is growing so rapidly. And even though China's growth is slower now than it was some years ago, it's so much more important as a major trading partner. So it's a fast-growing economy still, and we're benefiting from that. So
much was made out of coordinating policy worldwide as we were coming out of the crisis. Is it still relevant? Are you still talking as much to partners?
Well, look, I don't think coordination is realistic. I think the best you can hope for is each central bank does what's best under their mandates. And look, they're in the business these days of telegraphing their intentions and when their view of the world changes very clearly. So I think that's important to recognise. I just don't know that there is scope to coordinate. Their economies, as you suggested, are being pulled in slightly different directions or at different stages in the process of recovery, at least in the advanced economies, with the US much more advanced. Europe's still got a long way to go.
Okay. Now, turning towards home, your area of expertise, you're the head of economics research for the RBA. Despite an easing cycle that's left interest rates at a record low of 2.5%, the Australian dollar has remained stubbornly high. And you mentioned just now that that's the case. It fell below 90 cents for the first time yesterday in 6 months. The benefits of a high exchange rate you referred to some companies are clear, but how far does it have to fall until it provides a net boost to the economy?
Well, I think any decline, as you said, we've been at very high levels, it sort of provides sort of net stimulus to the economy compared to where it had been. I think the issue, particularly in the context of my speech, though, and I think the underlying current of your question is there some sort of trigger point at which that will help businesses, particularly in the traded sector, do a whole lot more investment? And I don't think there is, and probably the one thing we have to recognise is they're not going to react at a particular, necessarily a given exchange rate, and they're going to want to see it. If they need a slightly lower exchange rate to support that investment, they're going to need to see that lower for quite a while, I suspect, before they take on major new investment projects. But any fall is sort of helpful.
Obviously, it's a sliding scale, but is the ideal rate, do you think, for the economy? Does it start with an 8? Is it a low 8? Is it a high 8?
Yeah, I can't comment on what I think is necessary. I think the thing to recognise, too, is that the world's changing all the time. So when we quite explicitly said the exchange rate remained at sort of high levels, higher than perhaps what fundamental determinants might suggest, let's say earlier this year, things have moved on since then. Commodity prices have fallen a lot since that period. So it's really hard, I think, to know exactly what is sort of the right, where the exchange rate should be in terms of its fundamentals. You can have quite a bit of a debate even amongst people who sort of sit down and run these econometric models, which aren't that helpful, but they're the best we've got at times. It's a moving feast. It's hard to know. I wouldn't pick a number.
The NAB joined the debate. They said the Aussie would become the whipping boy of the G10. Are they right?
I'm not sure what they mean by that.
I think they meant it wouldn't be very popular.
Look, people get very emotive about these things. It's a relative price. It's a very important relative price. And, you know, I'll just restate. We've said that it seems to be higher than would be justified by long-term fundamentals. I talked about this in a speech earlier in the year where I said, well, that doesn't mean I can predict where the exchange rate's going to go. But it does mean that I wouldn't be surprised if it was to fall further. If you want to get emotive about that, I don't think it doesn't cause me to be emotional about it and use terms such as whipping boy.
Okay. Willie, do we have any burning questions on that topic?
Well, we have a variety of questions, but the first order of business is before you entered the room, we took a poll of the audience. And the question we asked was, should the RBA cut rates again in the next 6 months? Now, 67.6% said no, and 32.4% said yes. Does our audience have it right?
Well, let me put it this way and be rather provocative here. My understanding is that that differs somewhat from what the people who are actually putting money down on their bets suggest, which is pretty much for no change. And that's consistent for a while at least, and that's consistent, I think, with the messaging out of the board meetings of late. So there might be, if they truly are convinced of this, there might be some money for them to be making later this afternoon.
Now, Governor Stevens has been talking a lot recently about animal spirits. Could central banks be killing animal spirits through unprecedented intervention, which is driving uncertainty?
I don't see it that way, at least in the advanced economies, and not so much here. Remember, in Australia, we've had growth at or a bit above trend of late over the past year or so. But in many advanced economies, you know, their economies are weak. They've still got a way to recover, perhaps less so in the US, which is further along that path of recovery. But that's been brought about by, helped along by very easy monetary policy. Monetary policy is doing what it's intended to do. It tends to push up asset prices. It makes those who have good propositions for investment, it makes it easier for them to get access to money at low cost. So I think it's been very helpful. But what we face now is uncertainty about the sort of future course of monetary policy. And as we suggested, different countries pulling in slightly different directions at this stage.
When you look around the world, do you think that the risks are currently weighed towards global inflation or deflation?
Oh, I think it's pretty hard to see global inflationary pressures. You know, inflation is very low and well below target in the US. In Europe. In Japan, the Bank of Japan is trying to do everything they can to move to a world where people credibly think 2% inflation is the norm, and they've still got a way to go. They've at least seen some improvement after a long period of deflation. But I don't think there's a risk there. In the US, people are looking at this intently as to whether or not there are signs that inflation will start to sort of pick up. That's a welcome thing if and when it does happen, because it means the economy is getting stronger. But I don't think there's a real risk of excessive inflation at this point.
Okay, thanks, Willie. I'll come back to you in a minute. Chris, there was record Australian jobs growth in August.
Mm, it was.
And this is the first time I think someone from the RBA has been free to comment on it. Not everyone trusts the numbers. Do you?
Well, we always treat any given release with a deal of scepticism, not particularly that one, not the labour force necessarily. But I think you can't read too much into any particular series in any given month. Obviously, what happened with the unemployment rate over the last couple of months and the employment in the last month were rather exceptional. Those were very large movements. It's hard to know what might have pushed the unemployment rate up. It's hard to pin it on just the change in the definition of the unemployment rate that came on a couple of months ago. And indeed, more so perhaps when you recognise it's subsequently fallen. I think the thing I would say about it is it does make reading of the labour market difficult, but that's often the case. And you have to marry looking at any particular series, unemployment, employment, with a whole range of other data. I think when you put all of that together, what we've seen is that the labour market conditions generally are subdued, that there has been employment growth, but it hasn't been strong enough up until the last month to make inroads into the unemployment rate, which has been drifting higher. There have, however, been some signs across different indicators of a measure of stabilisation in the market, to some extent in the labour market, over some of this year. And some of the forward-looking indicators, job ads, vacancies, the business surveys, our own liaison suggests things are better on the employment front than they have been, but not necessarily strong enough to soak up pretty strong growth in the labour force. Remember, the population's growing at a reasonably robust pace. and that means the labour force is too. So with growth, our forecasts have it a bit below trend over the course of the next year. That means the unemployment rate's going to stay elevated. And, yeah, I don't think you can take a particular reading in any one month, particularly when it's as large as they have been of late, as sort of indications of the truth of the underlying trends, as I've just tried to outlay them.
Okay. Just picking up on the animal spirits in your speech, you know, at times you almost sounded exasperated that companies weren't taking the bait, they weren't responding to the elevated, the above average levels of demand and undertaking new investment. What more can be done?
Well, I wouldn't like to suggest I was exasperated. We've been exasperated. I think the point of my talk was to try and pick apart some of the explanations and see what are the most credible reasons why it might be have been as subdued. That doesn't tell us very much about the future. The CapEx data suggests some modest growth in investment this year is ahead of us. My sense of things is, if you step back, this happens in business cycles. At a point where investment's particularly weak, animal spirits are at their weakest. But those things change. One really helpful element, of course, is very low interest rates. We're seeing a pickup in demand in the non-mining economy. Firms tell us capacity utilisation; they've still got some spare capacity, so they don't feel the pressing need to invest. But with these sort of strong fundamentals in place, I think eventually that sort of those weak animal spirits will give way to something much stronger. And again, it's really hard to pin down, because it's one of those sorts of things where it's not just what I think about the future that entirely does it. It's what I think you think about the future. Mm-hmm. And that means it can sort of easily turn quite quickly.
Well, one of the elements you referred to was risk, and surely global risk is it anything going up?
Well, no, I mean, these measures of uncertainty that I sort of pointed to, they're probably, they're certainly lower than they were during the global financial crisis, and roughly around levels that are the norm. It's normal to have uncertainty, and businesses have to work in that environment and make their decisions. They can never be certain of anything. But as the measures I've showed suggest, it's not that elevated. If anything, sort of it's par for the course from prior to the GFC, which was a period of reasonably strong growth. So I don't think it's uncertainty so much in the way I've defined it.
Okay. Willie?
Now, please don't shoot the messenger. I'm just asking the question. Is the use of the phrase animal spirits really code for monetary policy and fiscal policy losing potency?
No, I think it's just the reality of what causes investment to swing considerably during, business cycles. It's not that we're really in a business cycle, but at least in the non-mining sector, things have been reasonably weak. There's been an improvement in demand. In time, I expect investment will follow. And then, as you can see in that last chart of mine, even in a few quarters, firms who tell the ABS at the similar time in the financial year as we're in now, oh, I think growth will be weak or only modest, they can turn around to be pretty decent growth in only a few quarters. No, monetary policy, I think, is working as you would expect.
And what signals are you using to determine if the housing market is indeed overheating and action is required to lean against a potential bubble? What are you looking at?
Well, again, we look at a wide range of things to think about the strength of any given market. And in the housing market, it certainly is showing signs of some renewed strength in house price growth of late, auction clearance rates. Much of that strength is in Sydney and Melbourne, and much of it's in the sort of investor market sphere. That's where credit's has picked up more noticeably of late. We're also seeing more supply coming forth. We're seeing building approvals at elevated levels. We're seeing dwelling investment picking up. That's sort of how monetary policy works. It provides support, including to interest rate sensitive sectors. The housing market's one of those. That typically has knock-on effects to other things like household consumption. So monetary policy, I think, is working. Are we concerned about it? Well, we're always careful to watch these sorts of developments. And we've been at great pains to always tell people, when you're making investment decisions, make them with great care. Don't assume prices can always and always will go up. Don't assume that the price increase that we've seen in the past is a reflection of where prices will be going in the future. And don't always assume interest rates will stay low for the length of your loan. So those are messages I think we've been saying for a long time.